And as we headed into the new century, I had two bands that were dominating my music, and Hot House was one of them, and the other was Dr. Robert. They had both planted their seeds just before the turn of the century, but we really planted our feet during the O's, and both bands were really good. You know, there wasn't a lot of talk about trying to make it in the music business, even though I was really trying to get Hot House to have an impact, at least in the wider blues scene in New England. But, you know, all those dreams I used to have about becoming a rock star, I was kind of beyond that. You know, I was getting older, and I was also getting wiser, so I kind of started seeing the music industry for what it is, rather than what the fantasy was, you know, maturing a little bit. There was some growth in the O's, but there was also a little bit of stability that I didn't have in the 90s and late 80s. Well, actually, mostly in the 90s, you know, after my divorce. Still drifting, but, you know, I had a steady girlfriend in the O's. Actually lived with her for a while. Tried to establish, you know, some kind of permanence. Really pushing Hot House. At this point, we had gotten two new members in Hot House. You know, we had initially had Glenn on bass, Ron on drums, and myself. And then we added a friend of mine named Mark LaForce, who called himself Ace. I look back on it, and I think it's kind of cute, kind of funny. Ace LaForce, harmonica player, occasional singer. Funny, nice guy. We wanted to push Hot House a little further towards the blues, because as I told you before, when we first got together and we made that CD, it was like trying everything in the world, everything from the Pretenders style music to hard rock and Clapton type tunes. Wanted to explore the blues, so we got a harmonica player. He was good too, and people liked him. And then we got Mike Lanigan, I think I mentioned that before, on guitar. He calls himself Tall Mike because he's about 6'5". He was great. And we got a lot of bookings, and it was great. People liked us, but people didn't love us. It was a small core of people that loved us. And I couldn't figure out why until towards the end of the decade, I looked back and I thought, you know, I was thinking about the people in the same circuit that are really popular, people like James Montgomery and such, you know. Yeah. And what they had that we didn't have was a really, really interesting a live performance that grabbed you visually. We didn't have a front guy. We didn't have somebody who you could get riveted to. And so we just performed. And Mike Lanigan, as good as he was, frankly, was pretty boring on stage. He'd probably be the first one to admit it. He didn't move around much, didn't have much of an expression on his face. He was internal. And he was the guy standing up front. But we still had our core people that loved us. And during that time, we actually got a chance to play at a couple of New Orleans festivals that were being put on around here by a gentleman from the area. He actually ended up booking us, opening a couple of the shows. You know, it was a big thing because he was booking big-time New Orleans acts and paying for him to fly up here and do these performances, and it was really a very neat thing. He did maybe four or five in a row every summer. We went back in the studio a couple times, but we never recorded an entire album like we did with just Glenn and Ron and I. We managed to get four or five songs on tape. It was kind of haphazard, but they're fun to listen to now.
And are these songs that you wrote?
Yes, all of them. Yeah. I have this one called Charlie's Place, and I was really proud of that because it's one of those, you know, where you're describing the people that are sliding up to the bar, and it was like a personality type song. you know, in the midst of all this trying to generate excitement and really kind of drifting in my personal life and things not really happening, I was making some great music. I mean, Dr. Robert was the best cover band I've ever been in. We were very popular. We would, you know, draw a full house a lot of times. We were almost the house band at the Sakura Tokyo. We had a good thing going. We made a good compromise between songs people really want to hear and trying to educate them with, you know, really good songs that they might have not heard otherwise. Like Mama Kin by Aerosmith. You know, no cover band does that song, but we did it, and we did it really good. There's this ballad from the Climax Blues Band that was a huge hit in the 70s. It was called, dumb title, I Love You. But it was a great song. And John, oh, could he sing it? So, you know, it was things like that that made it special. So, to sum up the O's, there was a lot of musical stability, a bit of personal stability. It didn't last, but, you know, we gave it our best shot, me and her. We got towards the end of the O's. That's when I really got into hosting blues jams, and I ended up becoming the host of a blues jam out in Warren. It didn't work out, and so people out there, way out there in the sticks, people just weren't coming in every week. I huddled with the other people in the band and said, we're going to move this. And I kind of knew the guy who ran Greendale's in Worcester. Asked him if he might be interested in the idea. Really, I mean, I hate to put it this way, but the rest is history. It was a big thing. And right from the get-go, people started piling in. I had a slightly different approach to blues jam than other people who hosted blues jams did. You know, I was a little more inclusive and trying to help people put their best foot forward, and people appreciated that, and audiences appreciated it. It was a big hit. It was a big hit, and it lasted through the teens. But that also got started in the late O's. As we headed past 2009 into 2010, there were other changes that were around the corner. And one other thing that happened in the middle of the O's was, of course, everybody knows that that was the era of George W. Bush, and the whole decade was pretty much post 9/11, and there was a lot of political stuff that was driving me out of my mind. By the time 2007 came around, and we were, you know, basically bombing the hell out of Iraq and making a mess of things, I decided to make a CD about it. And meanwhile, you know, I was still writing a lot of songs with Ken Jason, and his lyrics were getting more political. And he wrote some fantastic, fantastic, biting lyrics about the whole Bush era. And so I put some of his songs together with some of mine. I'm very happy with the CD, even though it was completely recorded at home. It was the only one I didn't use Roger in. It was just completely a home project. And the name of the CD was Blueprints of Ruins. And that was one of Ken's awesome lyrics, Blueprints of Ruins. The chorus is, the blueprints of ruins pretend to make us free, but the architects of illusion have become too blind to see.
Holds the leash.
But I think that was the highlight of my career with Ken Jason, that CD. His lyrics on there are just brilliant. So anyway, I wanted to mention that CD because it was a highlight of the O's.
Yeah.
I was working pretty much full-time on the Blues Jam once it settled into Greendale's in 2009. It took off like a rocket. And it turned out to be one of the most successful things I did in my whole adult life. Just because so many people told me as the years went on how much the thing meant to them. And they would come, you know, same people would come down every Sunday and they'd grab a table and they'd just sit there all evening and watch the people come up. I've developed a very good way of making all the jammers feel like they belong. It got a reputation, and all the way into Boston too, because I was able to bring some of Boston's best blues people in for sessions, for them being features. Really helped me too. I would go in and do some gigs with them and feature at their jams, and I started to get known in the Boston community. However, there was a little bit of a break because I don't know why I did this. I guess restlessness and maybe a little bit of foolishness. I moved to Florida. I had been communicating with a friend of mine. I won't mention his name, but he's well known around here. Keyboard player that had moved down to Florida quite a while ago. And we were going to start a production company. And there was all this talk about pulling it together. He was going to have a place for me to live. In one of his outbuildings, you know, it was a plan, and I moved down, relying way too much on him. In retrospect, it's my fault. He's a good drinker, and we had talked about how important the business was as far as us being sober and everything. I pulled up after driving down to Florida. And he came up to the house in the bag with a 12-pack and half of it gone and offering me one. And I knew right away. I spent 6 months in Florida, 6 miserable months. I fell in love with the beauty of the, it was January through July, so most of it was, not too hot. And it was beautiful countryside. I did get to go for a lot of rides. And went to some nature parks and stuff. I had to really scramble to get my own gigs. Long story short, it was a disaster. And while I was down there, my good friend Scott Marshall had taken over as the host of the jam. I had never expected to come back so soon, but he's such a wonderful guy with a big heart. He had said to himself when he took over, If Jim comes back at any time, it's his again. It's his jam. I didn't realize. But then when I decided I had to come back, I called him up and I told him I was coming back. And before I could even say anything, he said, "You want the jam back, don't you? It's yours." Nice. And I'm like, wow. And that's allowed me to get back on my feet in July of 2011. I got all my gigs back. People were great to me when I worked. When I left, I had been working at a music store in Southbridge. They took me right back, and I had a studio where I could develop some students. Also, I was able to reform Hot House, and we got onto a really nice streak for the rest of the teens. On top of that, also I reunited with the Silverbacks, which was great, and we ended up going on a golden age, so to speak, streak, which is still going to this day. Silverbacks are an incredible thing for me. So I was really lucky that even though I dropped everything to leave, everything came right back to me when I came back. I'm so grateful for all that. My era with Donny Sadowski I thought was pretty much done. But then when I came back, I had heard that this band that he had formed in 19, which was basically a Steely Dan cover, which ended up expanding to be a horn band that specializes in Steely Dan, basically, and did a lot of other stuff. They broke up. They had lost their keyboard player. And I thought, I can do this. You know, Steely Dan's music is not for the faint of heart.
No.
And I had always thought that even though I was a pop maniac, that I could handle it. I asked if he wanted to give it a shot. Anyway, it worked out. I was able to figure out those songs with a lot of help from their guitar player, Pete. And it was an incredible experience. And that lasted for the rest of the decade. And then also we decided, since we were playing together again, to reform the Ed Sullivans, which was the offshoot of the Time Machine. Donnie and I ended up playing together a lot and having a great time. I had a lot of things going, just like all the other decades, but at least this time, there was more stability.
Yeah.
Everything pretty much lasted all decade. And those were all the musical things that I was doing. In the meantime, a couple of other things. I was in a great relationship. Mary, it was fantastic. And we're still really, really great friends. But she introduced me to so many new things, including deep blues. She's really into the blues. She basically brought me down to the gut level with things like Willie Dixon and Muddy Waters and, Robert Johnson. And she understood where it all came from. And our relationship was very special in that way. She loved soulful music, rhythm and blues and all that stuff. We took many a trip together. We went to New Orleans. I completely changed. That's when I started wearing hats. And we used to joke that, using the terminology from New Orleans, that like overnight I became voodoo funkified. And I was a different person. I really was. And it really infiltrated the hothouse music. That was a big experience for me, New Orleans. And then we also took a trip to Memphis, and I went to the Stax Records Museum and Sun Studios Museum and all this stuff. And it was really an amazing time just exploring the roots of everything I was into in my life. And we went to Austin, Texas, and we went to a couple of blues festivals down in St. Augustine, Florida, the Tampa Bay Blues Festival. So, I was milking this whole thing to really expand my horizons and the music I was into at the time. And she was a wonderful part of it. And then the other thing I did, finally, this pretty much is it for the teens, but it's a big thing. I recorded a CD, which was also heavily influenced by the stuff Mary and I was doing. And the CD is called Meanwhile, I'm Still Thinking, which is a line from an old Chuck Berry song. And it kind of was aptly describing where I was in my life. Basically, meanwhile, after all the crap I put myself through decades and decades, I was still thinking, trying to think of my way through the next thing. So I thought it was appropriate.
She just loved to love me slow.
lot of different influences, but I was really proud of it. Once again, I went back to Roger LaValle for the sound.
And that was Making a Man Out of Me, the first track to Jim Perry's CD, Meanwhile, I'm Still Thinking.
And so as the decade came to a close, I decided I really had had enough of the blues jam. It's so much work. And it was on Sunday nights, and it got to be so that I was so tired at the end, I left my equipment there, and I would just go get it on Monday morning. And it just wore me out. I went from loving it to almost dreading it, just because of how much work I knew I had to do. So when a fantastic thing starts becoming a burden, you got to leave. So I did, and that was the end of the blues jam thing. One other thing about the teens that really kind of leads up to what I want to talk about in the you know, the final section, which is the first half of the 20s, and that's Donald J. Trump. You know, starting when he came down that escalator in 2016, I was just horrified, and I'm still horrified, and the whole experience is, you know, overwhelming. And it became so overwhelming even during his first first 4 years of his presidency, hopefully the only four, I started hearing stuff in my head and writing stuff because I had to. It wasn't because I was sitting around as an artist going, I have to come up with a new concept, or, and it was nothing like that. It was guttural. I had to write it because the whole Trump experience was overwhelming me. The reason I bring it up as part of the teens is because that's where the whole concept was birthed and developed. And unfortunately, Trump hasn't gone anywhere yet. But in the meantime, starting in 2019, I started recording because I had to. I have to keep saying that. I had to. It was like, if I didn't, I would have been miserable. It's this thing I can't explain. I came up with a name for it, dystopia. And I started hearing this pounding and thudding in my head, almost like Trump was this big monstrous balloon, fat balloon, coming down on us with big, huge, large steps. I came up with a musical riff, which is the musical version of that vision, which is the beginning of the song Dystopia. And it has that, you know, like the sound of crazy marching. And so that started the whole thing going. I called up Roger LaValle again, of course, told him what my idea was. We'll be right back. when we started recording together, I was still developing it. It wasn't like, I have all this stuff, now let's go record. So Roger helped me finish it in a big way, big way. I could almost call him the co-writer of some of the songs, but you know, it was just that he put so much effort into the engineering and the sounds and the arrangements and stuff. Blossomed into 6 different songs. And of course, a couple of the songs came from the library that I had with Ken Jason, songs that we wrote together from years before, including The Great Unrest and The Ballad of the Richest Man. And then one of my favorite songs on the CD, Crazy World, was actually a song that I had written back in the 80s during the Reagan era. So some things never change. So I had a really, really rough old recording from the original version, and I updated a few of the lyrics. I've always liked the riff and the hook and everything, so I recreated it as a dystopia song.
Turn to bad, and bad will get you high.
proud of this project. I feel like it's the apex of my recording career. I ended up making a video for the entire thing, almost like a dystopia film. And right now I'm in the process of working towards getting that out to the world. So that's where my music career is right now in 2024. I'm winding down. I'm semi-retiring from the whole rat race. I'm going to be 70 any time now. And I've had enough. I haven't had enough of life. I still love it. I still love playing, but just the rat race. I'm done. But it's been unbelievable. It's been so much fun, and I'm still pushing the dystopia thing, and life is good.
Jim, this Rock and Talk series has been amazing. Your life has been full of music all these years and full of great stories, and I'm so glad that you came in to do this interview series with me. Do you have any thank yous or closing statements or anything you'd like to tell the world?
And thank you. It's been great doing the show, too. It's almost giving me a chance to look back at my life and remember things that I forgot. Puts it in different perspective. So, in closing, what I'd like to do is thank all the musicians, not all of them, but everyone who was in the bands that I was in, and then a handful of other people, if you'll be patient with me, because it's a long list. I played with too many people in my life, but really, there's no such thing as playing with too many people. So we'll start with Albatross, the first band that I was in from the time I was 16 years old. Mike Lynch, singer. Cliff Goodwin, guitar player, who was in for a short time. The Martin Brothers, Paul and Jerry. Paul on drums and acoustic guitar, and Jerry on electric guitar. Bobby Palermo on the bass. We called him BP. John Bianchi first, and then Yale Beebe afterwards. That's right, Yale Beebe was his name, on keyboards. They were both great in their own way. Thank you all. And the Reflectors came next out of the North Shore. Steve Cataldo, the legendary Steve Cataldo, thank you so much for allowing me to be in your band. Bassist Jonathan Paley of the Paley Brothers. Drummer John Muzzy, and then after he left, drummer Jean-Dominique Sifantus. Everybody called him John Doe. Saxophonist Derek Dyer, who gave me the initial phone call to join the Reflectors. I would like to thank them all. Then came the Heartbeats, and that was a great little unit. Doug Hartwell, a really inspiring person to work with. Bobby Palermo returned to the fold to play bass for me. John Riley, J-Bar on the drums. Everybody loved J-Bar. He was my best friend through the years of the Heartbeats, and I miss him very much. He's not with us. And then we'll talk about Down East. Founders Donnie Sadowski and his sister Susan. John Webster on the bass. Then Bones Bob Maltito on the bass. Loved Bones, one of my best friends throughout my music career. Guitarist Peter DePasquale. Thank you all. Continuing on in the general business wedding band category, Dazzle, which turned into Dr. Robert, another group of musicians I've worked with for a while, some longer than others. Doug O'Malley on the bass and vocals. Thank you, Doug. Ron, we met on the drums, who became one of my best friends for years and years and worked with a lot of my original music. And love you, Ron. John Docimo on keyboards and amazing vocals. Great fun and a great career with Dazzle and Dr. Robert. Then we shift over to Hot House. Glendy Tommaso became a big part of my life. I teamed up for the first time with Mike Lanigan on guitar. Dave Kandarian, also known as DK. First time working with him. Brian Lewis on trumpet and Pete Levesque on sax. Thank you all to all those great musicians for making fantastic music with me. Then we have 19. Great musical experience for me. I expanded my abilities, I guess you could say, because it was challenging music. I'd like to thank Nancy Marshall, Donnie Sadowski once again, Pete DePasquale, Brian Lewis, again, on trumpet. Bob Breeze-Hofelter on trombone. And Don Hyder on saxophone. My first real big experience with a full horn section. Wonderful stuff. The Ed Sullivans, first Scott Marshall, then Doug Urquhart. And then I met Tom Yates, the great Tom Yates, wonderful guy. Donnie Sadowski once again. The last one is the chain. And we just disbanded a short time ago. And it was my final full band. Billy McGilvery on drums. I finally got a chance to play with my old friend Billy in a band. John Webster once again. Allison McTavish, who I had some great musical experiences with through the last 10 or so years. I just want to thank a handful of more people that weren't in the bands, had a lot to do with my successes and my failures. I'd like to thank Bob Rivers and Peter Zipfel, also known as Bob and Zip, from WAAF for the work on the parodies and just being great friends and giving me opportunities. The amazing Roger LaValle. What could I have done without him? Every recording I made, he was behind the board engineering and just being his usual genius self. Thank you, Roger. Everyone from the Blues Jam, including the owner of Greendale's, Ken, and all the musicians I played with there, and everyone who made me happy. Johnny Bluehorn, who I met 10 to 15 years ago, and we really have hit it off as far as being a duo, doing a lot of work in and out of nightclubs, in senior centers, all different kinds of work. Johnny's he's just fantastic. The Brumbies, Brett and Lisa, I love them both dearly, and we've done a lot of great work together, and I just want to thank them. Lisa Marie, who is a legendary blues singer. We did some great work together, and I love Lisa. And then Ed Shear, who is one of the most charismatic people I've ever met. He's the drummer for the Love Dogs, and he's a legend in the Boston community, and him and I have gotten close to. I want to thank all those people for enriching my life. And thank you all for listening.
Well, thanks for doing this, Jim. It was really a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Since recording this interview series with Jim in the early part of 2024, he has moved to Florida. He'll be back for gigs and to see his kids, so he's not that far away. And he still continues to do his show for WCUW on Thursdays from 4 to 5 p.m. remotely, which is really cool. Thanks, Jim. This really was an awesome interview series to do with you. I really appreciate it.